I'm Frank Vaughn. It's October 16th, 2024, and I am joined today by James Kitchen, who is a lawyer representing an individual that I don't even know if I can name. How about you introduce yourself, James, and tell us a little bit about your client and whether or not we can even talk about him by name.
Sure. So I like to call myself a civil liberties lawyer. I fight for free speech, freedom of religion, health freedom. I've done a lot of that lately, obviously, with the COVID stuff. So this whole thing with this individual, and the thing is you can't call him by both. You have to pick one or the other. And since we're talking about his court case, the right way to refer to him is CD. And just so people understand briefly, that's not even his initials. Like that's a complete anonymization of who he actually is. CD is just a moniker to identify this person so that this person CD can't be identified with the real person with a real name, which I cannot actually mention. And the whole point of me representing him now, because that's the only recent for me, is to get rid of that. We call that in law a publication ban, and this is a really extreme form of it, where we've publication banned his real identity out of existence, at least as it relates to this court case. And that's totally unacceptable in a free and democratic society, or at least one aspiring to be like Canada. So it's got to go. And that's why I'm currently representing him, is for that sole purpose.
Wow. So even though the major litigation in the case has already passed through, now correct me if I'm wrong, but it went all the way to the BC Court of Appeals. It didn't go higher. It didn't go to the Supreme Court, right?
Oh, that was it. Yep. BC Court of Appeal.
So even though that litigation has passed, this man faces a ban on the subject and his name in perpetuity if you don't get it lifted. Is that correct?
Yes, in perpetuity if I don't get it lifted. Yes. So this was put in, and if people remember the story, because it's going back several years now, CD had a child who at the age of 14 began to transition to a different sex or gender. He obviously, as a good father, disagreed with this. Obviously, it's terrible for any child to go through this. It's just objectively bad. I don't care if you're religious or not, or if whatever you are, wherever you are on the political spectrum, it's just objectively bad for teenagers to try to switch genders, which, of course, is, I mean, itself a fiction because you can't. So it's really terrible. And I've got to meet a lot of detransitioners through my work. So I've seen it firsthand. It's not just like I can make this up as a parent or I've read it in the literature. I've met the detransitioners. I've interviewed them. I've gotten to know them. And so he objected to this, and he spoke out about it. And so what the, basically the left woke, you know, pro-trans mob did is they went in and they told the court, well, for the sake of this child, the father's identity has to be taken away from him so that the child's identity can be kept secret. Okay. And there's an open question as to whether or not the child even wanted this. I mean, there's some activist lawyers that were on the side of the child who were going for this. And I mean, I'm sure the child sort of just went along and said that that's what the child wanted. And if you're wondering why I'm saying the child, it's because I refuse to participate in the fiction. But at the same time, I'm not going to go around and intentionally misgender the child just so that the court can get mad at me and I can have a law society complaint. So that's why I'm trying to ride that line by referring to the person as the child.
Certainly.
So they got that gag order. The court was tripping over itself to impose that publication ban to protect the identity of, or the secrecy of the identity of the child. And for the court, you know, it's for them, for the court, at least, it was a no-brainer to take away the identity of the father to protect the secrecy of the identity of the child. So the child now is now an adult. Okay, this person is an adult. This person's above the age of 18. And so now, even if there ever was really a justification to take away the father's identity in order to protect the secret identity of the child, that's questionable to begin with. But fine. So be that as it may, this person is now an adult. And obviously, or I should think it was obvious in our society, you don't have a complete right to secrecy. You have a right to privacy, which is different, okay? But you don't have a right to secrecy, right? None of us have a right to be secret. We only have a right to be private. So this adult's right to secrecy, which doesn't exist, this person does not have a right to secrecy, okay? So now what's happening is CD, the father, the person I represent, is coming in and saying, okay, I want my identity back because I have a right to it. And my right to my identity and everybody else's right to the open court principle and actually knowing who I am supersedes any sort of, you know, imaginary or fake right for an adult to be secret. And that's basically in plain English, that's what my argument's going to be at the court, is saying, look, we need to get the publication ban lifted because this person is an adult now and you don't have a right to secrecy.
Now, describe for a moment, if you can, that up to this point and moving forward, because I'm unfamiliar with how this factors in as you move forward, the sheer amount of resources, legal and otherwise, that have been arrayed and aligned against CD. Because it seems to me, especially as it progressed to the appeals court, that there was an unlimited amount of resources that promote this ideology, which is destroying so many children. And when you look at, for instance, when you look at the consent forms that they have to sign, these children are being asked to sign, or parents are asked to sign, it highlights all of the health hazards and all the health effects that are net negative. You can't get puberty back once it's interrupted. How many people, how many resources are allied with this movement to transition children?
Well, an enormous amount, and of course, I don't know all the reasons for that. You have to account for the fact that sometimes, not always, but sometimes the lawyers are doing this for free, right? So just like there's activist lawyers on the freedom side, like me, I do a lot of stuff for free and at a discounted rate. I mean, this case is a good example. There are activist lawyers on sort of the ultra woke side that do the same thing, right? They're not always charging. And of course, part of the reason they cannot always charge is because they're on the woke sides, they're sometimes getting very, very lucrative cases. I'm barely ever getting any lucrative cases because all my cases are freedom cases. But so that's part of it. The lawyers are tripping over themselves, you know, the extreme left-wing ones, to do this type of stuff, either for the fame or glory or because they truly, truly believe in it. And I think a lot of them truly, truly do. They believe in this. They believe that, you know, penises should be in girls' washrooms and 13-year-old girls should cut off their breasts as much as I believe in truth, freedom, and justice. They really do. You know, I don't think most of them are faking it. So that's part of it. But yeah, where all the money and the funding comes from, I really don't know. That's just beyond what I've dug into. But I mean, you we can speculate, right? I mean, there's the Soros types, billionaires going around and funding all the riots and stuff. And so presumably there are some very rich, I don't know, queer people, LGBT people, or maybe even people that aren't, but just want to fund it for some sort of subversive purpose, and they throw money at it, right? That's I, but it, there certainly seems to be a lot of it. Where it's coming from, I don't know, but there certainly seems to be a lot of it.
Yeah, it seems like there is this concerted effort. Well, if it's not concerted, it's hard to see it as accidental to undermine the very fabric of Western civilization in just about every realm, whether it's media, economic, family structure. And there seems to be an enormous amount of resources and pressure applied to that side. And there's very little left for people like yourself who are trying to advocate for common sense, freedom, and the personhood of this individual. So describe for a second what's left to do. What's the process that you're having to go through? What courts are you dealing with? And what's arrayed against you to get this man his identity back?
Well, so the court file that this ban originally came down on is so secret that even the court itself, or the registry, like the court clerks. You ever go into a courthouse, there's a bunch of women, usually. There's obviously some men, but it's usually a bunch of women, court clerks running around, and they're the ones doing the filing and they're pulling up documents, and they'll help self reps and lawyers file stuff in person. They'll bring up documents for media looking at stuff. They're, you know, if you go in, you got to file an affidavit. They're the ones that stamp it. These people are there's a ton of them at the courthouse, as there should be. These people sort of run things, right? So if I need to file something, then they're the ones that do it. They're sort of the gatekeepers, right? It's not the judges. It's not even necessarily the judges' assistants. It's these court clerks. We call them the registry. Okay. This case is so secret that the court clerks don't know it exists. They can't search it in their system. I can give them a court file number, which I have. I have the court file numbers because I have direct access to some of the court documents through CD. Okay. And his former lawyer. Otherwise, I wouldn't have access to them. There's no other way I can get access to them. So I give them the court file number, and they search it, and they're like, "This file doesn't exist. Therefore, I can't file this application." So in order to get rid of this publication ban, I have to file an application, court application to the court. I apply to the court. Okay, it's just called a notice of application. And you file that, and then you serve it on the other side, and then it goes to a hearing. That's how I do it a gazillion other times in my cases, right? I literally couldn't do that in this case. It was so secret. So, I mean, that's Banana Republic type stuff, right? Like there's this secret court file. Like, I mean, it's like, or maybe even make it a little more about, that's like, 1930s, 40s Europe kind of secrecy, right? Like that's the level of it. So that's totally unacceptable, first of all, right? And in fact, in one of the hearings before with the judge that made the latest version of the publication ban that I have to challenge, the last name is Tanneman, I think is how you say it. That judge commented on how he did not have access to the file. Okay. He could only have what he had something in front of him, but he couldn't access the rest of the file. It was so secretified. I mean, who the hell is doing that, right? Like, it's completely unacceptable. So I couldn't file. So I prepared all my stuff and tried over and over and over again to file, to try to find the file. Nobody would know. We went to every court registry in the province of BC, couldn't find it. So what I did, just to try to get things moving, is I filed a petition to remove the publication ban, its own new separate file. Okay, which you can do that, right? So I did that. And I sort of knew I'd run into troubles, but at least I'd get things moving, right? And you can imagine, obviously, why there's a benefit to this file being secret. The powers that be behind all this, if the file is secret, it makes it really, really, really difficult for anybody to do anything about it, especially if they aren't represented, right? I decided to get creative and shake the cage a little bit and file this separate thing. So the lawyers for the child and the mother who's supportive of the child wrote to me and said I should basically piss off. And so I said, well, that's fine, but I mean I and they're like, oh, just go file it on the proper file. And I was like, oh, I'd love to, but it doesn't exist. And of course you know that, and that's why you're saying that. So they just told me to piss off, and then they ignored me. And so I went to court, and I went to court in Abbotsford, and the original file was in Vancouver. And I went in Abbotsford just because CD lives in Abbotsford, that's all. And I get in front of the judge, who's very displeased, because he's displeased with me, he's displeased with the situation. He doesn't want anything to do with the file. He doesn't want to touch it with a 39 and a half foot pole. So he tells me, well, you've done this wrong. And I said, why? Well, I mean, I had no choice. The file doesn't exist. Like, give me a break. And he's like, well, you need to go file in the proper file. I said, well, I'd love to do that. That's actually, it's great. If that's what you can give me, that's what I'm here for. And he says, and I say, so can I have an order from you to permit me to file? And he's like, no, I'm not going to give you an order. And that's a little bit ridiculous. That's very unusual. If something like that is going on, you get a court order that has a judge's direction to tell what's going on. And I pushed him a little bit, and he interrupted me, he shut me down. He told me absolutely not, which is I mean, that happens sometimes in court, but it's a little bit unusual. Usually judges are, they at least have a discussion with counsel. That's what they're there for, amongst many other things. And he said, no, you can take the clerk's notes and take that to the courthouse in Vancouver and file on this. So I'm still waiting on those clerk's notes. I don't actually know if this is going to work. This idea of clerk's notes is bizarre. Lawyers don't take clerk's notes to go file something. They have an order from a judge or a fiat or something. But this judge wouldn't give it to me, which is strange. It's certainly unusual. So at this point, I'm still trying to file my application on the original file number to be able to lift this publication ban. So, I mean, I've been at this now for several months. I've been trying to, and I kind of knew it would probably be like this on this file. It certainly is absurd, and should be obviously concerning, right? You have a secret file number that even a lawyer can't file on. Then you go to the court to try to get it sorted out, and the judge doesn't want to touch it. He won't even give you an order to permit you to file. He says to take the clerk's notes. It should raise eyebrows, and it should get people upset. And I know some people would just say, well, all the judges in the courts are just all in on it. And I don't know, maybe they are. I'm going to assume they're not. Maybe they are. But I tend to think the problem is just more everybody is just doesn't care, or is sort of like scared of it, and just sort of only cares about their own reputation. And the fundamental problem with a lot of things in our institutions, courts and otherwise, is most people are just so concerned about their own paycheck and their own career, and they just don't care about higher principles anymore. I mean, you don't get the kind of madness we had through COVID if at least some of our civil servants actually cared about higher, well, actually knew what higher principles were and actually cared about them. Most of them are just like, hey, We'll just we'll go with the flow. I want my paycheck. I want my career advancement. I don't care about much else. I think sadly, a lot of judges for the last 10, 20 years really fall into that. They didn't. They certainly didn't used to. If you go back and look at Supreme Court justices from the 70s, 80s, 90s, maybe even the early 2000s, and sorry, during that early period of the charter, these higher principles really mattered, and judges would really follow them, even if it made them, legally or socially or politically unpopular. They would do it. I don't see that anymore. Nowadays, I really see judges are just sort of, and that's a terrible way for the for our legal system to be running. I think that's part of the, this is getting a little academic, but it's part of the problem with the whole idea of our Constitution as a living tree that can bend and move however we want it to. It's a terrible idea, right? Because it encourages this lack of principles and just this, let's just follow whatever society is, right? Whereas, in the American model, it's like, this is the way it is for a quarter of millennia. We're not going to change it. It stays the way it is. That encourages these higher principles to be valued and to perpetuate. So that's a little bit getting broader and grander, but that's, I mean, I that's, you know, there's some deep problems with our Canadian society and judiciary, and this case sort of reveals some of those problems.
Well, the whole idea of a judiciary is that it's an independent body that actually holds to a set of principles regardless of politics. It's a depoliticized institution. But in Canada, politics is, or sorry, the judiciary is very deeply politicized. I've done a lot of reading of Solzhenitsyn, and I'm sad to say, very saddened to say, that when I look at the revolutionary courts, if you can call them that, in Leninist times, I see a lot of parallels to court decisions now. Because it seems subject to the political whims of the day, which is one of the weaknesses of the charter. This whole idea of reasonable, you would know the terminology, it'd be probably right in your head, but reasonable limitations. There's a reasonable limitation, but that's determined by politicians in the main in the moment. So back to the point, the justification for the secrecy was that the courts had to, and this is the official justification, had to protect the rights of a minor to not be targeted, not be known, and to live their life privately. But the issue is this minor is now an adult, and his personhood or his ability to talk about things as himself is still in this limbo. And the secrecy is you it's you can't even uncover the secrecy because the secret is buried so deep that you can't even get your hands on the files. And I remember at the time when this was going, weaving its way through the court system, that a lot of the individual details about who was advising the minor, how they were being coached, how this decision was arrived at, would have been very damaging for the people who were involved. So they used this pretext of protecting a minor to hide the details of the case, which I think the public would be served in knowing. Is that fair as well? Like if you get this lifted, will we get to know the details as the public?
No, if CD gets his identity back as it relates to this case and can talk about it, and people can put the pieces together, he still won't be able to talk about the names of the doctors. Obviously the name of his child will remain anonymous. Details without names he can talk about, but it's still the names he still won't be able to talk about. I could try to get that lifted, but I can tell you right now that wouldn't happen.
Yeah, be roughly impossible to do that. This has been going on now for how many years?
Oh, about 6 or 7. A lot of this stuff blew up in around the 2016 to 2018 period. A lot of this stuff really blew up. That's where Barry Neufeld's thing started. This thing with CD, a
Yeah.
number of other trans things really got. That's where a lot of the trans litigation really took off in those few years.
So James, I don't want to take too much of your time. Can you talk about some of the other cases that you're working on? You mentioned this COVID period, and I'm assuming some of your cases involve the individual rights that have been completely annihilated and stomped on over the last 3 years. Do you want to get into that a little bit more? How people can find you?
Sure. So I do finally have now have a website. I started my practice about 3 years and a few months ago, mid 2021. And prior to that, I worked at the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedom. So I, this type of public interest litigation, civil rights stuff is just, it's been my whole career. It's my passion politically, personally, and legally. I just love it. So I did that. I worked at the Justice Center for 4 or 5 years, decided to start my own firm, partly because I do have very strong libertarian views. Those views fit right into the Justice Center, but then COVID came, and I was the crazy libertarian who opposed lockdowns from day one. So there was a little bit of tension there, and I was just kind of like, I don't know if this is where I want to stay permanently, because I am pretty radical when it comes to freedom and libertarian. Javier Milei, or whatever his name is, there, the guy who runs Argentina. I mean, he's my kind of guy, you know, freedom, damn it. So that's kind of where I am on this stuff. So I left the Justice Center and started my own firm. And I also wanted to help people who came to the Justice Center, had money, but we just didn't have the capacity. They were looking to actually hire a lawyer, right? And that's what they wanted. So there was nobody was doing this type of work for hire, for pay in Canada, or at least very, very few. So I decided to do that. And of course, immediately, right, this is the summer of 2021. So obviously what almost all my cases were in the fall of 2021 was the COVID vaccine mandate cases. Right, because they all happened from September to January. Those 4 months was just it was nuts for me. I went from having 10 clients to 210. It was nuts. So I tried to help people keep their jobs, get accommodation, or just whatever, right? As students too, helped a lot of university students try to get accommodation to stay in class. And for the most part, I was unsuccessful because most people just thought at that point it was just the law literally did not matter. Everybody was in some sort of weird panic mode or oppressive mode or whatever, and it was very hard to get people to care at all about the law. A few people did. I kept a few students in school, helped a few people keep their jobs. And so obviously what happened, immediately after that crazy period in 2022, I filed a number of human rights complaints and employment lawsuits about people who lost their jobs, right? And generally these people were they were fired for cause, right? It's not like, I mean, I negotiated a few severance settlements, but most of them were fired for cause, which is just sort of crazy because, I mean, it's just so offside the last 300 years of law that we have on this type of stuff. So, the wheels of justice move pretty slow, especially in Canada. So, now we're in late 2024. And so the first trial I have on one of these cases is coming up this February. Well, I've actually two. We have two coming up this February, and then we're going to have more throughout 2024 and 2025. So trials in front of courts and hearings in front of human rights tribunals. I've settled a number of them, a significant number, probably about two-thirds of the cases I have settled for significant sums. So, for whatever reason, a lot of these employers, the discrimination and the employment law violations, they decided to say, okay, I don't want to fight this in court. I'm gonna settle and give people some money. So I have gotten people a lot of good settlements. That's great. Most of that's quiet. Most of that I don't announce or I can't announce. The clients don't want me to, or if I did, it just wouldn't make that big a news. You can see some of the cases I've done with an organization called Liberty Coalition Canada. We did some COVID vaccine mandate cases with them. So you can go see a little bit of that on that website. And then, so that's where I'm still doing a bunch of that stuff. Now I'm doing some more other general, trans stuff and other just general issues of free speech and freedom of religion that aren't all just COVID. Because now, obviously, I mean, the limitation periods for a lot of that stuff has gone on, right? It's after 2 years, so I'm not taking new COVID cases, generally speaking. And one of those, of course, is the Barry Neufeld case. That's a famous human rights case in BC with Neufeld, who was a school trustee who basically just said, transitioning kids is child abuse. And he said 100 other things, but they pretty much can be summarized by that statement. And the teachers union has gone after him, saying that, look, you discriminated against us as teachers who are gay and trans by saying those types of things. And it's hate speech and it's discriminatory. And, the Human Rights Commission should punish you for it. So that's going to a hearing on November 25th, a virtual hearing. People can attend it. It's open to the public. It's going to be for 2 weeks, on November 25th to whatever in December. So I'm doing that, and that's going to be interesting. I'm excited about that. That's bread and butter type stuff for me. The free speech of the Human Rights Tribunal on the defendant side or on the plaintiff side, people who were discriminated against on the basis of their religious beliefs. I have a lot of Christian clients. I've had a couple Jews and a few others, but a lot of Christian clients, because of course everybody loves to discriminate against Christians. So, and the human rights commissions hate those cases because they don't like Christians. They like all the other religions, and so I'm always fighting with the commissions to keep those cases alive. So I do a lot of that stuff. And then of course, I have a case like Monique LaGrange, school board trustee, who was kicked off the Catholic school board in Red Deer because, she basically said it's not good to teach kids all this trans ideology, and of course, all the woke school board trustees lit their hair on fire and kicked her out. So I'm waiting for a court decision on that. That's the type of stuff I'm doing. I mean, if you want to see more, I mean, you can search me on just basically, I mean, I do all kinds of interviews with the Rebel and stuff, so you can find me online. I do have a website. It's kitchenwellsllp.ca. So you can go on there and you can just see the type of stuff I do. It's a brand new website, so a lot of my cases that I've done aren't up there yet, but you can at least see the type of stuff I want to do if you're interested to potentially hire me yourself. So I hope to get more of the cases I do up there and you know, sort of try to one thing I try to do, because I don't think enough lawyers do this, if they do this type of work anyways, is to actually like publicly post a lot of their materials. So I'm trying to do that. If you go on Liberty Coalition Canada, for example, all the cases I have on there, probably the most famous I have is with Josh Alexander, and that's the kid who was kicked out of high school for saying penises don't belong in the girls' washrooms. You can see all my material. It's posted up there. I do that on purpose. I try to bring some transparency and accountability and visibility to what this stuff actually looks like, right? And of course, I mean, a lot of my cases are crowdfunded. And of course, if I'm going to ask people to donate, they need to see the product they're paying for, basically. If you're donating, you're paying for a product. And so, same thing with Barry's case. Barry's got no money. I've said it's probably going to cost $60,000 if I actually get paid for the amount of time I'm going to work, spend on the case. And so everything I've done in his case, for example, is up on his website so that people can see, okay, if I'm donating to Mr. Basically, I'm donating to Mr. Kitchen. I mean, I'm donating to Barry, but where's the money going? It's going to Mr. Kitchen. Is he, you know, like, what is he doing? Like, what am I actually paying for? And so I encourage people to go and see my product and see if they actually think it's good. And then they actually know what they're donating their money towards. I think it's pretty good. I mean, I wouldn't do this type of stuff if I didn't feel like I was actually competent at it, because it's enormously difficult to do this type of stuff because there is so much scrutiny, right? You can be just kind of a, you know, whatever, a moderately talented lawyer, doing whatever normal stuff that nobody ever knows about, and do just great financially. But if you're going to do what I do, you got to be good at it, and you got to be willing to expose your work so that the public can benefit from it, and the public can know what they're going to donate towards it if they're going to donate. So that's sorry, that was a little bit long-winded, but that's me and what I'm up to now.
Well, no, I think my audience is going to benefit from knowing all that. You seem to be at the forefront of a lot of causes that need representation. There aren't a lot of people who want to touch this stuff because it can be very detrimental to your career, and it does invite the great eye of Sauron to go against some prevailing paradigm, regardless of how unjust it is. That's all amazing. So it's November 25th. There's a live hearing that we can tune in and we can watch that as regards Barry.
That's right.
And I'll make sure I put links in the description to all of your work, so we can watch you go forward into the future.
That sounds good.
I think Zoom is going to kick me off here soon. So, is there anything else you'd like to say to finish, sir?
The thing I always like to tell people is don't self-censor. You gotta keep speaking your mind, take the risks to do it. The risk is worth it. You'll feel better. And if our society's gonna last, it's going to be because enough people don't self-censor.